It is a delight to be here. And yet I'm conscious that whilst we might be 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 in the building, we are six online, last I noticed, 7. So we outnumber you online just yet. 8 now. We won't keep the count up, it's all right. So we're looking at the book of Esther tonight. Esther comes pretty much at the end of those historical books in the Old Testament. And we have one of the challenges of Esther is that we have both, as it were, the canonical Esther, and then there is an apocryphal set of additions to Esther, which in Bibles like this one that I got given when I was ordained has the Apocrypha in it. And this particular version has the whole of Esther reprinted along with the extras. We won't look too much at that one tonight, but we'll stick with the canonical version of Esther. The Apocrypha, by the way, is those a set of writings that were created in the intertestamental period, that period between the Old and the New Testament. So Esther is one of those, a very rare book in that sense, as we've heard, of a book that doesn't immediately and doesn't explicitly, more to the point, mention the name of God. There's no reference to the temple, to sacrifice, to prayer, to Sabbath keeping, to kosher food laws or circumcision. And yet the book of Esther, upon which the Feast of Purim, the Feast of Chance, or the Feast of Coincidence is part of the Jewish, even now, Jewish, how can we put it, tradition, if you like, is that at the Feast of Purim, so the whole of the book of Esther is reread, but in a very audience participation kind of way. So whenever the bad guy, whenever Haman is mentioned, so there's lots of boos and, you know, there's kind of football rattles that you can get, those are used. And it can take quite a long time to get through the whole of the book of Esther. So we're not going to try that today. Where's the camera? There's the camera. Hello, online. We're not going to try that today, but we are going to think carefully about the book of Esther and about how it works, if you like, how it is that it's so much a book of chances or of coincidences. And one way of looking at Esther is just to take ourselves through it, but another way is to notice that there are often pairs of incidents which leads us to a unique chapter that is, if you like, the climax of the book of Esther. And so what I propose to do is that once we get to chapter 6, which is the climax, we'll read that in total, but notice stuff, as it were, on the way in and on the way out from that climax. So the book opens inevitably with an introduction, with an understanding that we are in, as it were, a foreign court. King Xerxes, King Artaxerxes, manages to display his wealth for 180 days, 6 months of feasting. And towards the end of it, he decides that the best thing to do is to ask his wife to come and give them a dance in her royal crown. However, most likely the best translation of that is that actually it is wearing only her royal crown. In other words, in her birthday suit with a crown on. And that makes for an interesting image that perhaps we kind of need to move away from fairly quickly. But it is therefore, to my mind, not terribly surprising that the Queen, Queen Vashti, says no way to her husband. Now, disrespecting the vicar is one thing, but disrespecting the king, The king who has the power of life, the power of life and death, is another thing altogether, and quite possibly the queen would have lost her life because she had disobeyed the command of the king and disrespected him. However, she was not actually killed, which is probably quite a relief for Vashti. But you recognize the seriousness of her willingness to die rather than to dance before basically a bunch of drunk, leering men. And we'll come back to that whole question of how do we read Esther today? But notice that there is that sense of this queen stands up to her king. So there's effectively a royal beauty talent, beauty parade created to discern who might be the next queen. And Esther, who is the hero of our story, is caught up in that search for the new queen. And she's taken into, in custody, effectively, where they are fed and pampered and beautified and brought before the king one night at a time, one person per night. And they only go back to the king if he remembers their name, if he calls for them again. Not quite if he remembers the name. He could equally. But when it comes to Esther, she is the king's favorite. And so she becomes queen. Now, at this point, we do not know of Esther's Jewish heritage. It's only in chapter 3 where we pick up something of this of Haman, who is the principal antagonist, of his hatred for both Mordecai and the Jews. It's in chapter 3 that we kind of change direction. We move from the introduction to how it is that Esther becomes queen to this unpacking of Haman's distaste and hatred, both for the Jews and then for Mordecai, who turns out to be Esther's uncle. And so he persuades the king to write a decree to destroy these people, to destroy the Jews. And if you know the story of Esther, you'll know that eventually there's a second decree that's produced. And this is part of that sense of the parallels as we go in and out of the main part of the book. Chapter 4 has it, that sense of Mordecai persuading Esther to help. There's a plan, there's a rescue, and it's in the midst of this that we get the phrase that is so often repeated. Who knows, perhaps it is for such a time as this that you have come to this royal position. That's Esther 4:14. But also Mordecai shows a real sense of faith. Let me read you the first part of 14. He's talking to Esther in this, 4 verse 14. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. And over the years, many people have, for themselves, brought that sense of a parallel that actually sometimes we are placed in particular places for a particular purpose, for such a time as this, where we need to stand up and be counted and risk our lives for the sake of others. Because that's actually what was necessary for Esther. She, her, her, basically, if you went into the king's presence and he didn't choose to welcome you by offering his scepter towards you, then you were taken off and killed. So he had to actively welcome you into his presence. And Esther feared, because the king hadn't asked for her for some time, and so to enter enter without being asked risked her own life. But that's exactly what she did. We see in chapter 5, we see Esther inviting the king and Haman to a banquet, because she wants to ask them something. But it feels as though she kind of bottles it and says, no, I can't ask tonight. And so when the king basically challenges her as to, well, why are we here then for this beautiful food? She says, well, let me come back tomorrow and we'll have another feast and we'll talk again. That night, the king cannot sleep so well. I wonder whether he'd had too much cheese, but that's my take on it, perhaps. Let me read you chapter 6. That night, the king could not sleep. So he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king asked. Now, just pause there a minute. What are the chances of some attendant randomly opening the annals of the records of the king at that point in the history of the king? Hence, again, it's the feast of chance, the feast of coincidences. That night, it transpires, the king cannot sleep. That night, he asks for some of his history to be retold to him. That night, they happen to hit on that particular incident where Mordecai, Esther's uncle, has been a loyal servant and basically grassed up these guys that were going to assassinate the king. So the king asks, what honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? Oh, nothing has been done for him, his attendants answered. The king said, well, who's in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows that he had erected for him. And his attendants answered, well, Haman is standing in the court. Oh, bring him in, the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? So he answered the king, well, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn, and a horse that the king has ridden, and the one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man and the king delights to honor, and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. So Haman describes what he'd like to see to honor himself. And remember, he's just turned up hoping to get Mordecai hanged on some gallows that he's erected in his front garden. And the king commanded Haman, verse 10, go at once, get the robe and the horse, and do just as you suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything that you have recommended. Imagine the embarrassment. This is Haman, who absolutely hates Mordecai, who really wants to kill him, and yet he's been told, find a horse, find a robe, not just any old robe, a robe the king has worn. A horse the king has ridden. Get the royal crest, put it on the front of the horse, and lead Mordecai the Jew through the city gates, city streets, and shouting loudly. This is what the man, what he's done for the man the king delights to honor. You can just imagine the farce that there is in this. This is the climax. This is the one-off bit of Esther. So afterwards, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told his wife Zeresh, and all his friends, everything that had happened to him. Now Haman's advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. While they were still talking, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Clearly, the night and the morning and the day have all rolled forward in this chapter. And so he's taken away to the second banquet. Just notice there that commentary from his advisors. Let me read it again to you. Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, then you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. Notice that implicit recognition that God is in control. They're basically saying, this stuff is not chance, it's not coincidence. God will follow through on what's beginning to happen to you. And these are people who are in no sense God's people. But they have hung out, they've been near, they've understood the Jews enough to recognize that God does follow through on what he started. I think for me there's echoes in there of Jonah and that sense of Jonah trying to run away from God, but when the sailors hear that he's a God follower, they go, oh, we're ruined. You know, that's it, you know. But yeah, and Jonah then says, but equally, if you think of, say, it's somewhere in Acts, isn't it, where the Pharisees suddenly begin to say, look, if this is of God, we've got no way of standing against this. But if this is man-made, if Jesus is man-made, then, you know, it will come to nothing. So if God gets involved, notice that God's going to follow through. Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, then you cannot stand against him. That sense in which Mordecai is God's and God will act on his behalf. Anyway, so we then move into the repeats, if you like. We've got chapter 7 takes us back to the banquet, the second banquet. But equally, at the end of the first banquet chapter, chapter 5, we had a little bit of a little episode around how Haman has built the gallows against Mordecai. And then in chapter 7, you have the second banquet and another return to the gallows. But actually this time, because Haman is killed on those same gallows that he wanted to hang Mordecai on. Because Esther has exposed Haman and his plan to kill all the Jews, including Esther, therefore. And of course, the king loved Esther. But again, what was the chances of that, given this bevy of beautiful ladies, that the king would choose Esther as his new wife? There's just so much chance in all this. We move on, chapter 8. there's Mordecai's rescue plan and a request for another decree from the king to basically allow the Jews to defend themselves against attack, because decrees were decrees. You couldn't change them, but it's, you know, a bit like papal decrees. You know, you can't change them, but you can write other things that maybe change the outcome without changing the decree. So chapter 8 has a second decree that's written, and it's spread out to all the people, and they are allowed to defend themselves from attack. And so chapter 9 then has the, as it were, the outworking day of those decrees, when actually it's not that the enemies of the Jews kill the Jews, but the Jews, because they're allowed to defend themselves, end up killing their enemies. And so there's that reversal of the initial intent of the decree, and all sorts of people are named as being killed, including the 10 sons of Haman. But if you like, that then gives us that parallel with way back in chapter 3, when you had the first decree produced. And then inevitably you want a conclusion to go with the introduction, and the conclusion comes in chapter 10, where we hear a little bit more about Xerxes and his promoting of Mordecai. Mordecai was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, held in high esteem because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. And that's how it ends. So we have a very clear structure, lots of chance, lots of, I suppose, bawdy farce at times. You know, you think back to the queen being asked to dance merely in her crown. And there's lots more like that that gives us that sense that this if you like, this was so serious that the only way to cope with it was with comedy. Now, I know that sounds a little weird, but that what we're talking about here, if that first decree had happened, would have been the annihilation of the Jewish people. And clearly, it didn't happen like that, as the initial intent. But almost the way of coping with the seriousness of that is to make light of it, is to create a sense of comedy, almost, in the retelling of the story. Now, you might ask, it seems like a really good book as it is, so why bother adding to it when you get to the Apocrypha and extra stuff? Well, basically, the extras that we get in the Apocrypha are things like the apparently full text of the letters that were written. Things like Mordecai going off and praying, and so, for example, in chapter 4, where Esther says to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days." There is. Sorry, it's one of those. Yes. So there's lots more as it were, detail that brings God very clearly to the fore, which almost takes away from that sense of which God is in every chapter, every page of Esther, but without being mentioned. And that almost is one of the beauties of the way it's written up, huh? That God is clearly in control, but God is clearly not mentioned. But it's there. It's that sense that, if you like, that echoes that reality that research suggests that 90% of people do pray, at least in a crisis, but only 5 or 10% at the moment come to church or go to church, put it that way. So there's that sense in which there's a shared understanding of God and of God's character, God's power, God's commitment to protecting the Jewish people. So, there is a very challenging in these days difficulty, isn't there, with Esther, in the way that there was clearly male patriarchy. There was that sense in which Esther could not enter the presence of the king without risking her life. That sense of, to go back a queen, Vashti, being able, the king feeling he could command her to turn up, and the consequences for her in not turning up to that feast to dance. And so are these chapters around objectifying women, exalting male chauvinism? Or actually, do we need to read this much more as strong women standing up to their unjust men? Of women willing to risk their lives for the sake of others? Which, when you... given it's Remembrance Day, we're all reminded of that sense of so many people, and in the First World War, certainly largely men, went to war and risked their lives for the sake of others. But actually, in Esther, it's the women that risk their lives for the sake of others. So maybe we need to forgive Esther for, on a surface reading, feeling like an objectification of women, but still it's there, isn't it? That sense of, you know, how on earth could you decide that you want to choose a queen by having a beauty parade? In fact, more trying them out a night at a time. It's a harem. I mean, yes, there was good keeping of the harem pure. They were looked after by eunuchs. They were only allowed to go once to the king. They didn't return. So all of the things you might think about in terms of sexually transmitted diseases, they kind of understood innately in order to keep the king from getting any of those STDs. And in order to stop the ladies being taken advantage of, shall we say, because all the men were eunuchs. Let's not go there. Where am I going over here, though? So, there's something clearly here about the providence of God, about God's being involved in the details, about Esther being selected as queen and putting her in that place so that she was in the right place to bring about their salvation. But equally, Mordecai being in the right place so that he can understand and hear the plot to kill the king, to report it, someone wrote it down. there's lots of God's hand to be seen in this. There's lots of God, if you like, working behind the scenes. There's lots of recognizing that actually God works together, works things together for good for those who love God. If you like, things turned out really well for Mordecai, but really badly for Haman. But also that sense in which, sadly, it feels as though over history, the Jews as God's people are often persecuted. There was an intense hatred from Haman for the Jews. He wanted to exterminate them. Yes, it was logical. Yes, it was irrational. But he was evil. But it was only when Haman, if you like, learned of Mordecai's ethnic identity that he planned to destroy all of Mordecai's people, not just Mordecai himself. Destroy, kill, annihilate all the Jewish people, young and old, women and children. That was Haman's hope. But that was thwarted because God intervened, even though we don't get God mentioned. So what about us? How do we live in the light of Esther? I think part of how we live is about recognizing that sense that God is with us. That what might feel like random chance that you have a particular conversation with somebody or you miss that bus and you have to wait for another bus, that's not random chance. That's God, if you like, orchestrating. It feels a bit like we're puppets, doesn't it? But it's effectively God orchestrating the events in our lives to bring about the purposes that he desires. So for me, and I trust for you, that's partly about going, okay, God, you've placed your spirit in me as a deposit guaranteeing what is to come. I want to do your will. Help me to discern what you want me to do. Do you want me to talk to that person or that person? Or both? And what do you want me to say? Because God is with us. He's there, even when it feels like he's not. Even when we don't necessarily stop to pray, he is there. And actually, wherever we are, even if it feels like we're in the wrong place at the wrong time, maybe we are in the right place at the right time to do God's work. So what we can't quite see with our eyes, we need to believe with our hearts. So although it might seem that God is absent, actually this is nothing new. The book of Esther encourages that even if we can't see God, God's hand, to be patient, to step out and in faith, believing that we are in the right place. Now, I have no idea how long I've gone for. And it looks like my view of the stream has frozen. So apologies if you're on live chat and you asked a question and I haven't seen it, because I seem to be frozen. Anyway, I've said, I think, about half an hour's worth. There's a man with a microphone. Over to you.